The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading today from the February 5th, 2021 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a canyon. It's got a bridge across it. It's one of those old rope bridges with wood slats, characteristically wobbly. The ropes look frayed. Some of the wooden slats are missing. On the far side of the canyon, the Republican elephant is standing there. He's got his arms crossed behind his back and a scowl on his face. In the foreground, just stepping onto the bridge very tentatively, is the Democratic donkey, looking a little apprehensive. The headline is Meet in the Middle, Why Biden's Call for Unity May Go Nowhere. That's our first main story, and we will start right there. A bipartisan battle over unity. What happened? President Joe Biden's aggressive pursuit of a progressive agenda sparked growing opposition from Republicans this week, as both conservatives and liberals accused each other of souring any chance for unity. Biden came out swinging with an unprecedented flurry of executive orders and actions, signing more than three dozen in his first 7 days. Many were aimed at overturning Donald Trump's policies on the environment and immigration, including orders that ceased border wall construction, rejoined the Paris Climate Accord, and revoked the Keystone XL pipeline permit. Others focused on social justice and delivering aid to the needy, including measures to expand food assistance and extend legal protections for transgender people. Biden's ambitious agenda, including a proposed immigration bill that would offer millions of undocumented residents a pathway to legal status and citizenship, drew fire from Republicans, who said its sharp progressive bent belied the president's plea for bipartisan unity. He may use the language, the rhetoric, even the demeanor of a centrist, said Senator Marco Rubio, but so far his policies don't seem to represent that. Republican opposition hardened against Biden's $1.9 trillion coronavirus rescue/stimulus plan, which the president has cast as crucial aid for suffering Americans in an economy hammered by the pandemic. Many GOP lawmakers called the bill too big. They targeted a provision to send $1,400 stimulus checks to most Americans, which Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said would direct huge sums toward many people who are still working. Biden expressed a willingness to negotiate, including on the stimulus checks, but he faced pressure from some Democrats to push the bill through the 50-50 Senate without Republican support, even if it means using a process called budget reconciliation. It's important that Democrats deliver for America, said Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. If Republicans want to cut back to the point that we're not delivering what needs to be done, then we need to be prepared to fight them. What the editorial said. No, President Biden has not already renounced unity, said the Washington Post. Biden is exercising the usual powers of the presidency by advancing policies he campaigned on, including climate change, immigration reform, and LGBTQ rights, all of which enjoy broad popular support. If Republicans want a voice in these policies, they should engage in good faith negotiation. Their demands for centrism are cynical and self-serving, especially after they spent 4 years enabling a president who at every turn sought to divide the country for political gain. Biden seems to think Americans should unite around one point of view, said the Wall Street Journal. The words in his inaugural address that seemed to cast his political opponents as racist and nativist brought to mind the condescending way Barack Obama cast ideological differences as divisions between enlightenment and bigotry. If Biden's vision of social justice means blaming every inequity in American life on racism, and he casts climate change dissenters as deniers who are happy to destroy the planet, he will alienate millions. What the columnist said. Democrats worked long and hard to gain power, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post, and they should use it with determination and without fear. Republicans' laughable idea of unity is to steer clear of anything they oppose. Negotiation over the details is fine, but citizens voted in record numbers to give Democrats a mandate to act decisively on climate change and the pandemic, and to rescue a broken economy that's left the poor and working class facing hunger and fear. Biden's call to unity is more fig leaf than honest invitation, said Michael Goodwin in the New York Post. His blitzkrieg of overreaching executive actions, including economically disastrous environmental policies and an immigration bill that would flood the border with new migrants, make clear the only common ground he seeks is with his party's far-left fringe. Republican insistence that Biden meet them in the middle is a farce, said Tim Miller in TheBulwark.com. Consider Senator John Cornyn's complaint that by lifting Trump's transgender ban in the military, Biden is being divisive. Polls show 71% of Americans opposed that pointless, mean-spirited ban, which the military also opposed. How warped do you have to be to think that the unifying political position is banning patriotic Americans from volunteering to serve their country? Biden faces a choice between fighting for a bold agenda and forging bipartisan agreements, said Sahil Kapoor in NBCNews.com. For Republican leaders, unity means avoiding actions that antagonize their base. And there's no way to reconcile that with a progressive agenda that includes trillions of dollars in new investments and an overhaul of the country's health care and immigration systems. Which way Biden goes will carry high stakes, not only for the lives of millions of Americans, but for the short-term future of Democrats, whose fragile hold on power will face the verdict of voters in the 2022 congressional elections. What next? If Republicans try to block President Biden's $1.9 trillion relief bill, Democratic leaders will try to push it through without their support, said Lauren Fox in CNN.com. Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says the Senate could move as soon as next week to pass a budget resolution, the first step in writing a bill that under Senate rules can be passed with a simple majority, rather than a filibuster-proof 60 votes that would require buy-in from 10 Republicans. It would be just the first step in the technical process known as reconciliation, which requires crafting the bill's language along specific guidelines and undergoing a rigorous review process. While it may ease passage, reconciliation comes with its own headaches for Democrats, said Jacob Pramuk in CNBC.com. The narrow reconciliation rules restrict what lawmakers can include, and narrowing of eligibility for the $1,400 checks may be needed to avoid defections among moderate Democrats. Controversy of the week, impeachment. GOP circles the wagons around Trump. The much-anticipated Republican Civil War is over before it even began, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. Immediately after the January 6th Capitol riot, it seemed possible that Senate Republicans would join Democrats in voting to convict Donald Trump of incitement of insurrection at his second impeachment trial. Even loyalists like Senators Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell expressed their disgust with the outgoing president after he whipped a MAGA mob into a frenzy. Count me out Enough is enough, Graham said after the Trumpist and white supremacist groups rampaged through the Capitol, killing a police officer as they hunted for Vice President Mike Pence and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. But after the damage and blood stains were cleaned up, Trump's iron grip on the GOP quickly returned. State Republican organizations rushed to censure the 10 House Republicans who voted to impeach, with Oregon's GOP even claiming the Capitol riot was a false flag operation by unspecified leftist forces, and congressional Republicans quickly fell back into line. In the House, at least 107 GOP members are now calling for Representative Liz Cheney, chair of the Republican caucus, to be demoted for having voted to impeach. In the Senate this week, 45 of the 50 GOP senators, including Graham, voted to dismiss the charges against Trump on the grounds that he's already left office. The writing is on the wall, said Jim Newell in Slate.com. Once again, elected Republicans are ready to let Trump off the hook. Republicans have the Constitution on their side, said Robert Delahunty and John Yoo in NationalReview.com. As the framers wrote in Article 2, impeachment is a tool for removing the president, vice president, and all civil officers of the United States. Donald Trump is now a private citizen roaming the fairways and greens of South Florida, and impeaching him would be unconstitutional. Democrats insist there are good legal arguments for impeaching an ex-president for his actions as president, said J.T. Young in WashingtonExaminer.com. But the rest of America sees no point in dragging the nation through another divisive impeachment trial just to remove from office a man who is no longer in office. Yes, ex-presidents can be impeached, said the Washington Post in an editorial. This is the view of most constitutional scholars, and common sense backs them up. If Congress could only impeach sitting officials, those officials could simply resign to escape any consequences. In 1876, Secretary of War William Belknap resigned as impeachment loomed. Congress impeached him anyway. The Senate not only can convict Trump, said Jessica Levinson in NBCNews.com, it has a constitutional duty to do so. If it's not a violation of a president's oath to ask a mob to stop Congress from certifying his opponent's victory, what is? A conviction will enable the Senate to bar Trump from ever holding office again and would send an essential message to future authoritarian politicians. Republican senators might consider their long-term interests before giving Trump another pass, said Adam Serwer in TheAtlantic.com. Yes, the base still identifies with the disgraced ex-president, but Trumpism has already cost the GOP dearly. Does the party really want to double down on the cult-like extremism that filled the Capitol with rioters and turned once red Arizona and Georgia into states with two Democratic senators? Sadly, Republicans no longer have any shame, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. If they acquit Trump of his blatant assault on democracy, far-right violent extremists will be exultant, and January 6 will be strengthened as a radical rallying cry. It was a good week for a peaceful transition after President Biden decided to keep Donald Trump's Diet Coke button on the Resolute desk and use it for other purposes, perhaps to summon Orange Gatorade. Trump liked to push the button and tell guests it launched a nuclear strike. The butler would then bring a fresh Diet Coke on a silver platter. It was a good week for fleecing the gullible after Oklahoma lawmaker Justin Humphrey proposed creating a Bigfoot hunting season as a revenue creator, complete with permits, fees, and a $25,000 reward for anyone who manages to trap a live Bigfoot. And it was a good week for cancel culture after One America News Network deleted articles from its website claiming Dominion voting systems had rigged its voting machines to steal votes from President Trump. The deletions came after the company sued Rudy Giuliani for $1.3 billion. But it was a bad week for Creative Legal Defensive. After a Houston police officer, Tam Din Pham, was charged with participating in the deadly January 6th storming of the U.S. Capitol, despite his claim that he entered the building to take pictures of historical art. It was a bad week for mistaken identity after a middle-aged woman in Mexico stabbed her husband after finding photos of him having sex with a younger woman on his cell phone. The images were actually photos of the husband and wife from decades ago that he uploaded. And finally, it was a bad week for having no place to hide. With the first confirmed case of COVID-19 in Hawaii's Kalawaho County, an isolated tiny island, population 70, formerly used as a leper colony. It had been the only U.S. county free from the coronavirus infection. And a short news piece before we leave the page. Senate confirms Biden's state defense heads. The Senate confirmed President Biden's choices to run the state and defense departments, overwhelmingly approving Lloyd Austin as the nation's first black Secretary of Defense. Austin, a one-time four-star general, retired from the military in 2016. He was confirmed last week on a vote of 93-2 after receiving a waiver from a rule that requires active duty officers must wait 7 years before heading the Pentagon. He is the third general to receive such a waiver in history and the second in 4 years. Antony Blinken, a longtime Biden aide, was confirmed this week as Secretary of State on a 78-22 vote. He began his tenure by ordering a review of several Trump-era policies, including a record-low cap on refugees allowed into the U.S. Briefing page article is titled The Reality of Brexit. The EU trade deal is finally done and Britain is now post-Brexit. What will that mean? Why did Brexit occur? Resentment of European Union bureaucracy, tensions over immigration, and a yearning for British independence. When British voters went to the polls in 2016 to decide whether to remain in the EU or split from it, the Vote Leave campaign led by Boris Johnson made big promises. Johnson, who is now Prime Minister, led rallies around the country in a red bus emblazoned with the slogan, "We send the EU £350 million a week. Let's fund our NHS instead." This was a claim that the UK transferred 455 million euro to the EU every week, and that all that money would be saved under Brexit and diverted to the struggling National Health Service. Vote Leave told voters that the UK would keep its tariff-free trade with the EU, the UK would no longer be subject to EU law, and could take back control of immigration. Wages would be higher. Most important, the UK could sign new trade deals with other countries on its own terms. Brexit, in other words, would bring great benefits with minimal cost. How much of that came true? Only some. Instead of a soft Brexit, which would have kept the UK in the EU's customs union and closely tied to Brussels, Johnson delivered a hard Brexit that is more of a divorce. The 1,200-page trade deal, clinched just before the end of the year, does provide for tariff-free trade in goods, but that came with a big catch. Companies that import and export goods face a raft of new paperwork, including customs declarations and border checks, that will cost them millions of pounds a year. The deal, meanwhile, does not cover the services sector, which makes up 80% of Britain's economy and includes financial companies, tech and data companies, entertainment, tourism, and healthcare. What access that sector will have to the EU market won't be known until a separate agreement is made later this year. As for the financial savings, the true net amount that the UK paid to the EU was $208 million a week, less than half of what was claimed. And little of that money is going to the NHS, which remains strapped for cash. While the border between EU member Ireland and Northern Ireland will remain open, there will be customs checks. Is the UK free of EU dictates? To a degree. The UK is free to make its own laws as long as they don't undercut the trade deal with the EU. But that deal contains a key clause that says the UK gets tariff-free access only as long as both sides have a level playing field. The EU wanted to make sure that the UK didn't gut its labor or environmental protections in order to be able to undersell EU farmers or manufacturers. Any disputes that arise between the two entities will be settled not by the European Court of Justice, which was seen by the Leave camp as a monstrous infringement on British sovereignty, but by an independent arbitration panel. The panel's oversight will still constrain the UK's decisions. What about the economy? The UK Office for Budget Responsibility predicts that Brexit will cost Britain about 4 percentage points of its gross domestic product over the next 15 years. Unemployment, inflation, and public borrowing will all likely rise, and many of the immigrant workers who have long staffed the NHS and provided low-paid labor to business now feel like unwanted foreigners and may go back home to find work or find work elsewhere in Europe. Britain has punched itself in the face, said Stanford economist Nicholas Bloom. It imports goods and exports services, and it's lost the freedom of services. Johnson counters that the UK will strike new, more lucrative bilateral trade deals with non-EU countries, such as Canada and the US. What have Britons lost? The freedom of movement that enabled them to travel to, live, and work without paperwork in the rest of Europe. The 250,000 Britons who retired in sunny Spain or other EU countries must now apply for residency, while business travelers may need visas. In foreign policy, the UK has lost the clout that comes from being part of the third largest economy in the world, after China and the US, and now stands alone as a relatively small nation of 66 million people. What have they gained? Sovereignty. The UK now has total say over whom it lets in as an immigrant, and it no longer has to bow to laws enacted in Brussels. British laws will be made solely by the British Parliament, said Johnson, and will be interpreted by British judges sitting in the UK courts. Further gains, Johnson said, lie in the future. The newfound ability to set their own standards, to innovate in the way they want, he said, will allow the UK to become a world leader in the industries of the future, such as biosciences and artificial intelligence. European allies, though, still view the departure as a mistake. Brexit, said French President Emmanuel Macron, was the child of European malaise and lots of lies and false promises. Scotland eyeing independence. Brexit could cause Northern Ireland and Scotland to split from London. In a February 2020 poll, 48% of Northern Irish said they'd support a reunification with Ireland if it meant regaining EU membership, while 45% opposed it. The Scots are even more restless. In 2016, Scotland voted strongly to remain in the EU, 62% remain to 38% leave, and Brexit has only served to bolster support for Scottish independence. In a 2014 referendum, 55% of Scots opted to stay in the UK, but now polls show an even larger minority want to go it alone and rejoin the EU. Given that the vast majority of Scottish trade is with the rest of Britain, not with the EU, such a leap might be more costly than many Scots imagine. Still, after Brexit was complete, The country's pro-independence first minister, Nicola Sturgeon, tweeted, "Scotland will be back soon, Europe. Keep the light on." Read a few of the best columns of the week, starting with two from the U.S. The first is titled, "How to Fix Social Media." With former President Trump banned from Twitter, Facebook, and several other sites, the siren calls for social media regulation will soon become deafening, said Andy Kessler. Most would-be reformers want to rewrite Section 230 of the 1996 Communications Decency Act, which largely exempts social media companies from legal liability for what users post on their sites. But attempts to fix Section 230 would massively backfire, forcing Twitter, Facebook, and others to heavily censor on their sites all controversial posts, lest they be sued into oblivion. We often forget, however, that Section 230 doesn't forbid suing users of social media for libel or holding them accountable. The problem is anonymity. The nastiest and most irresponsible posters hide behind fake names and handles. Forcing users to register with, say, a credit card or other ID and use their real names might cut the site's users' bases in half, but advertisers would rejoice, and it would limit the need for tens of thousands of content moderators. If you post threats or libelous attacks on people, you will risk getting sued. Post about buying zip ties and invading the Capitol, and the FBI knocks on your door. Ending anonymity would put an immediate damper on today's worst offenders. Why we must support foreign dissidents. President Biden's foreign policy should have one guiding principle. Put dissidents first, said Brett Stevens. The U.S. is facing a growing threat from autocracies such as China, Russia, and Iran that crush freedom at home and export repression and illiberalism abroad. These dictatorships are too powerful to be brought down militarily. But as the brave Russian dissident Alexei Navalny is now demonstrating, all regimes are vulnerable to domestic opposition that galvanizes public indignation through acts of exposure, mockery, and heroic defiance. It was Nelson Mandela who brought down apartheid in South Africa, Lech Walesa who ended communist control of Poland, and truth-tellers such as Alexander Solzhenitsyn who weakened the Soviet Union. Biden and Secretary of State Antony Blinken must make support of dissidents in Hong Kong, China, Russia, Iran, Cuba, and Venezuela inextricable parts of American statecraft. We should amplify dissidents' messages, and all negotiations with these regimes should include a demand they release jailed opponents. A foreign policy that prioritizes dissidents would immediately revive America's moral leadership, undermine our adversaries, and increase the chance that one day these regimes will collapse. And this is a column from India. What if we paid housewives? An Indian actor turned politician thinks housewives should be paid for housework, said Anusha Chandrakaran. Kamal Hassan says that if his centrist People's Justice Party wins control of Tamil Nadu's state legislature in this May election, it will mandate such payments. It's only fair, his party points out, because the typical Indian woman does 5 hours of housework and child care a day, compared with half an hour for men. But who would pay them? Husbands? Government? Tax subsidies? Hassan wasn't specific. In any case, compensation is entirely unrealistic unless we change the mindset that domestic work is the domain of women. That patriarchal concept is partly rooted in Hinduism, which associates the fireplace, the grinding stone, the broom, the pestle and mortar, and the water pot with impurity, and therefore with women. Nor can we separate the issues of domestic work from caste. Even today, maids, who generally come from lower castes, are treated as polluting, with households laying limits on where they can enter and what they can touch. It will take a huge shift in Indian thinking to treat household work as worthy of compensation. Payment for household chores to homemakers alone won't by itself raise women's status, but it would be a start. Time for the last word, our in-depth article, titled this week, COVID's Long Reach. When I fell ill with COVID in the spring, I knew I'd have a tough battle, said Laura Holson in the New York Times Magazine. I didn't know that the disease would come at me over and over for months in unexpected ways. I remember the second time I thought I would die. The first time was April 17, 2020, when, after finding out I had COVID-19 9 days earlier with aches and a cough, my fever shot up to 101.8. I could barely breathe, and my family doctor told me I had bacterial pneumonia. It was a perilous time for New Yorkers. About 1 in 3 patients admitted to hospitals with COVID were dying alone in their beds, while refrigerated trucks stood sentry outside to hold the bodies. Some nights I heard as many as 7 ambulances an hour on the streets below my Upper West Side apartment. My doctor, who called daily, diagnosed my pneumonia after hearing me breathe over the telephone. She vowed to keep me out of the hospital and prescribed a potent antibiotic that left me weak-kneed and dizzy. Within a few days, the pneumonia began to clear, but I was left with a cough, nausea, fever, and chest pressure that was so severe at times that it felt as if an anvil had been placed on my rib cage and I couldn't catch my breath. The second time I thought I would die was different, yet eerily the same. It was June 22nd, nearly 3 months after the initial diagnosis. But then the cough had softened, and I was well past the acute phase of COVID-19, having tested negative twice. The chest tightness had passed, supplanted by a nagging ache. I had lost 8 pounds as nausea dampened my appetite, and my heart seemed to race without reason. I was so tired I sometimes fell asleep upright in my chair. On that cloudless day in June, I was seated on the couch working on my laptop when, at about 4 p.m., the crushing chest pain I experienced during COVID's earliest days suddenly returned. My pulse began to quicken, and a shawl of heat gathered around my shoulders, crept up my neck, and swallowed my head. I began to sweat. It felt as if the air was being squeezed out of my lungs. Breathe, I told myself. Breathe. I stood up, gasping, and walked to the window to look outside. Could this really be happening again? I did what I did during one of my worst days with COVID. I lay face down on my bed and took deep breaths until the pressure passed. I called my family doctor, who gave me the name of an infectious disease specialist. A few days later, I was in the specialist's office, and he was examining my chest. He said one of his other COVID patients had similar symptoms. I'm worried you might have a pulmonary embolism. We need to get you tested. A blood clot could have traveled to my lung from another part of my body. Almost 23.5 million people in the United States have come down with COVID-19 as of mid-January, according to Johns Hopkins University, and the number of deaths now stands at more than 400,000. What has been discussed less is that for some of us, months of lingering symptoms make you wonder if you will ever be okay again. Fever, fatigue, heart palpitations, and brain fog are some of the common long-term symptoms. The experience can be much worse with inflammation of the heart, stroke, kidney damage, and inability to focus, and depression. No one really knows how many people suffer from long COVID. A new study of 1,733 COVID-19 patients who were discharged from a hospital in Wuhan, China, the original epicenter of the pandemic, suggests that three-quarters of those patients had at least one symptom, like fatigue, muscle weakness, or diminished lung function, after 6 months. A U.S. study showed that symptoms even persisted among some people with mild cases, including young adults. The coronavirus affects each person differently, and what I've learned these past 9 months is that my recovery is singularly my own. I live alone and, after lockdown began, worked from home at my job as a visual editor at the New York Times. I left my apartment only a few times before I got sick to go to the grocery store and to the post office. 5 days after my trip to the post office, where I was wearing a mask but few others were, I had a fever and my body shook with chills. Though I was in my 50s and in good health and had no pre-existing conditions, it would be 7 weeks before I returned to work, and when I did, I still didn't feel right. My chest pain returned the week after I began working again in May, this time as a stabbing pain under my left breast, followed by a fever of 100.5. My D-dimer level, which measures the possibility of a blood clot, was elevated, when it was infinitesimal compared to that of some patients who have died from COVID complications. The research was disturbing, so my doctor investigated further. She ordered a scan of my lungs to see if ground glass opacities or light-colored patches appeared, a sign that COVID had affected my lungs. She also ordered an electrocardiogram of my heart and an ultrasound of my lower extremities for blood clots. The results from my test appeared normal, but I still felt uneasy. 2 months after contracting the virus, I couldn't predict which part of my body would go haywire next. In early June, my hair began falling out a few strands at a time. Every morning after a shower, I would find wisps of wet blonde hair stuck to the bottom of the tub. Using a blow dryer hastened the loss, and larger clumps would cling to my fingers, which I tossed like airy cotton into the garbage. My doctor thought it was because of stress due to the virus. All I knew was I had less hair after COVID than before. More vexing was the brain fog that, for COVID survivors, can include memory loss, confusion, difficulty focusing, and dizziness. When I returned to work, I found myself losing my train of thought mid-sentence. One afternoon in mid-June, it took 20 minutes to write a paragraph that, on a typical day, took me a quarter of that time. What followed was downright bizarre. An electric current, or what felt like one, traveled from the left side of my chest, skipped up my neck, and stopped at a spot on the right side of my skull. The sensation vanished as quickly as it appeared, so I went back to writing. A few days later, I thought I would die for the second time, and found myself in the office of the infectious disease specialist. On June 26, he called with the results of my CT angiography. The test detected no pulmonary embolism. Whatever had happened seemed to have resolved itself. The markers of inflammation in my body and D-dimer levels remained elevated, although they had improved from previous tests. This was another hallmark of recovery. The gains were incremental. The good thing, the specialist said, was that the numbers were coming down. He ordered a 6-week leave from work so I could rest. When I had more good days in a row than bad ones, I would be on the mend, he said. But he warned me that it could take months. Having long COVID imposed a certain order over life. By July, I had my routine down. I slept 10 hours a day or more. Upon waking, I took my temperature. Next, I would measure the amount of oxygen in my blood using a pulse oximeter. I would repeat this 3 times a day, sometimes more. Back in April, when I tested positive for COVID, I had a blood oxygen level of 95%. It improved significantly after I recovered from pneumonia, hovering near 99%. July 9th started out like any other day in post-COVID life. My temperature was 98.3 in the morning and rose to 99.7 by 7 p.m. I didn't think much about it when I called my brother. I was accustomed to the temperature fluctuations by then. But at about 11 p.m., I started to feel faint. Then what felt like a warm ball gathered at the top of my shoulders and started to rise until my whole head was engulfed in heat. Beads of perspiration formed on my forehead. My hair was saturated at the roots with sweat. Within a few minutes, my whole body was sopping. The backs of my knees, my forearms, and shins. I took my temperature at midnight. It was 100.1 and rising. And I packed my head in ice to cool it off. I took 2 Advil and crawled into bed. In the morning, the fever was gone, but it had been replaced by a wave of convulsive chills that persisted for 2 hours. I took a tepid shower and some more Advil and drank a quart of water, concerned I would be dehydrated. I crawled back into bed and stayed there all day. At 7 p.m., as expected, my temperature rose again. Only this time it was accompanied by chills and body heat. My face was flushed and, as they had 2 nights earlier, beads of sweat covered my forehead. No, 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 I said to myself, this can't be happening. Maybe through the force of my will I could make my fever go away. I put ice packs on my back, mostly because it felt good. I drank water and crawled into bed, overcome with fatigue. There I fell asleep at 11 p.m. and didn't wake up until noon. As quickly as the chills, fever, and fatigue appeared, they were gone. Like the movie Groundhog Day, I would relive the worst of COVID over and over until one day, hopefully, I would not. At the University of California, San Francisco, Michael Peluso, an infectious disease doctor and co-principal investigator of a study of COVID's long-term impact, and his team have been interviewing about 250 COVID-19 survivors since April. In early interviews with subjects, Peluso told me recently, he would tick off a list of possible symptoms from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He quickly found out that some people's symptoms diverged from the CDC's initial list. Patients described phantom smells, like burning cigarettes or burned meat. Others complained about low blood pressure that resulted in fainting. I never knew what people were going to say, Peluso told me. People would periodically have heart palpitations or shortness of breath out of nowhere. Some study participants, he said, began to feel better only 8 months after the first diagnosis. The hard part is there is not a standard answer for everybody, Peluso said, adding that it will take a while for us to understand what we have collectively been through. On November 3rd, 2 months after my September setback, I visited my doctor for a follow-up exam. It had been nearly 7 months since I came down with COVID, and I could tell from the creases around her eyes that she was smiling beneath her mask. "You look pretty good," she said. "How are you feeling?" "My hair is growing back," I said, holding up a tangle of short bangs. For the previous month, I had been living in a cottage on Cape Cod that a friend offered to me. I focused on exercises to strengthen my lungs and increase my stamina. The random chills and night sweats largely stopped. By Thanksgiving, I noticed my fevers had subsided. I was still fatigued, sometimes spending half of Saturday in bed recovering from the week. But I seemed to have more good days in a row than bad ones. Life was edging closer to normal. For me, life is slowly getting back to what it was in pre-COVID days, even as I've accepted that nothing will feel natural during this pandemic. I still tire and sleep more than I want, but I don't text my doctor as much, and the ice in my freezer is used for drinks, not cold packs. As my doctor would say, I'm moving in the right direction. but my thermometer and pulse oximeter remain on the dresser by my bed so that I can use them every morning. Maybe it's just for the sense of security they provide, but I'm not ready to move them to the bathroom cabinet yet. I don't think I will be ready to do that for a long time. This was adapted from an article that originally appeared in the New York Times Magazine. Thought I'd read both of the obituaries for you this week. We seem to be losing a lot of the great ones lately. The home run king who bested Babe Ruth, Hank Aaron, 1934 to 2021. For Hank Aaron, breaking the most celebrated record in American sports was more than a matter of physical prowess. It was also a feat of psychological resilience. As the Atlanta Braves slugger approached Babe Ruth's record of 714 in the early 1970s, he was bombarded with hate mail and death threats from people outraged that a black athlete might surpass a white baseball icon. "My gun is watching your every black move," read one letter. It didn't stop him. On April 8, 1974, Aaron hit his 715th homer, smashing a slider over the left center field fence at Atlanta Fulton County Stadium. Baseball's new home run king received an 11-minute ovation and a hug at home plate from his mother, who later said she was shielding her son from potential gunmen. The 20-time All-Star retired from playing in 1976 with 755 career home runs, a record that stood for more than 30 years, but remained scarred by the racism he'd endured during the Ruth chase. "It really made me see for the first time a clear picture of what this country is about," Aaron said in 1994. "They carved a piece of my heart away." Born in segregated Mobile, Alabama, Aaron grew up idolizing Jackie Robinson, who broke baseball's color barrier in 1947, and learned to bat by swinging at bottle caps with a broomstick, said the Washington Post. By age 15, he was playing baseball regularly on semi-professional teams, and at 18, he signed with the Boston Braves. Aaron was dispatched to Jacksonville, Florida farm team, his first time sharing the field with white players. Fans hurled slurs and sometimes projectiles from the stands, and a guard once mistook Aaron for a trespasser and shot at him. At age 20, he made his debut with the Braves, recently relocated to Milwaukee, and promptly drilled a ball that carried over the wall, said the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. The slim 6-foot rookie hit 13 home runs that season before being benched by a broken ankle. Aaron won the National League batting title in 1956, hitting .328, and the following year was named the league's most valuable player, with 44 home runs and 132 runs batted in. That season, he hit an 11th inning homer to help the Braves clinch their first pennant, and he shined as the team defeated the New York Yankees in the World Series, the only championship of Aaron's career. In 1966, the Braves alarmed Aaron by moving to Atlanta. "I have lived in the South," he said, "and I don't want to live there again." The quiet and understated Aaron continued to rack up home runs in Atlanta, ending the 1973 season one shy of Ruth's record with 713, said the New York Times. He slugged his 714th homer on opening day 1974 off the Cincinnati Reds' Jack Billingham, and his 715th 4 days later against the Los Angeles Dodgers. Believing many Braves fans were indifferent or hostile to his feat, Aaron played his final two seasons with the Milwaukee Brewers. He retired with the most RBIs and third most hits in baseball history. His home run record was finally bested by Barry Bonds in 2007, but Aaron was privately said to be offended by Bonds' alleged use of performance-enhancing drugs. Over time, Aaron came to see his march to 755 runs as a part of the civil rights struggle. "There was a reason I was chosen to break the record," Aaron said. "It's my task to carry on where Jackie Robinson left off, and I only know one way to go about it." The talk show host who interviewed presidents and psychics, Larry King, 1933 to 2021. Larry King could schmooze with anyone. As host of the CNN talk show Larry King Live from 1985 to 2010, he interviewed thousands of guests, including heads of state, six U.S. presidents, athletes, entertainers, authors, CEOs, sex therapists, and psychics. He tossed questions at the Dalai Lama and Paris Hilton, Margaret Thatcher and Marlon Brando, Muammar al-Qaddafi, and O.J. Simpson. Hunched forward in his suspenders and rolled-up sleeves, gazing intently at his guests through horn rims, King commanded more than 1.5 million nightly viewers at his peak. "America watches him," said former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev when asked why he went on King's show. Detractors cited another reason some guests favored the show: a bantering softball style that sidestepped pointed inquiries. King was unapologetic about his friendly approach, saying it put the spotlight where it belonged. "I think the guest," he said, "should be the expert." He was born Lawrence Zeiger in Brooklyn, where his parents owned a bar and grill, said the Los Angeles Times. His father died when Larry was 10. Devastated, he became a troublemaker who squeaked through high school. Larry then worked odd jobs while dreaming of a radio career. Hearing Miami was a good place to break into broadcasting, the 23-year-old headed south and found a job sweeping floors at a small AM station. One morning, a disc jockey quit, and Larry was asked to step in. Judging Zeiger too German, too Jewish, the station manager suggested he switch his surname to King. King's local rise was quick, said the Daily Telegraph. Within a few years, he had a morning talk show on a larger station, a TV show, a Miami Herald column, and a spot as a color commentator for the Miami Dolphins. He lived large, driving a Cadillac, gambling at the racetrack, and marrying a former Playboy bunny, the second of his eight marriages. But as his career flourished, his problems multiplied, said the New York Times. Facing heavy gambling losses, he plunged into debt and declared bankruptcy. In 1971, he was charged with defrauding a former business partner, and his career nosedived. By 1975, the scandal had largely blown over in the Associated Press, and he returned to Miami radio. 3 years later, he began hosting a nationwide call-in show on the Mutual Network. Airing from midnight to 5:30 a.m., the Larry King Show expanded to 300 stations and made King a national phenomenon, leading to a primetime deal with CNN in 1985. King had conducted some 50,000 interviews by the time he left the news network in 2010, amid declining ratings, said the Washington Post. He continued to appear on a smaller cable outlets into his 80s and won a loyal Twitter following with rapid-fire observations. "Of what possible use is the pinky toe?" that he tagged, hashtag, it's my two cents. A longtime chain smoker, he was beset by medical problems in later years, including heart attacks, lung cancer, and a stroke. Despite his setbacks, he spoke of his life with a sense of wonder. "For this to all happen to a Jewish kid from Brooklyn," he said, "is a damn impressive thing." And we've just enough time for a few short pieces on the Talking Points page. Start with, the true number of COVID deaths is 44% higher than the official count of 420,000, according to a data analysis of nearly 800 counties. Undercounting was most prevalent in counties that supported President Trump, the analysis found, with many COVID deaths simply not diagnosed or reported as such. Donald Trump made 30,573 false or misleading claims during his 4 years in office. He averaged six such claims a day in the first year, 16 in the second, 22 in the third, and 39 a day in his final year, including more than 800 repetitions of the big lie that the 2020 election was stolen. In the first 3 weeks it was administered, the Moderna vaccine caused only 10 confirmed severe allergic reactions out of 4 million doses, a rate of 2.5 reactions per million shots, according to a CDC study. A similar study of the Pfizer vaccine found 11 allergic reactions for every million doses. And the poll watch, 51% of Americans think the Senate should convict Trump of inciting the storming of the Capitol on January 6. 37% don't think he should be convicted, and 12% are unsure. 55% believe Trump should be barred from ever holding office again. And we'll finish with a quote from the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., who says, "Nothing in all the world is more dangerous than sincere ignorance and conscientious stupidity." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.